Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I am your host, Julia Tertian. Thanks to OXO, one of the most trustworthy brands I know, for making this episode possible. For more about OXO and all of the everyday objects they make, head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. This episode is brought to you by my upcoming cookbook, Simply Julia. Simply Julia contains 110 easy recipes for healthy comfort food, and it explores all the various ways I define healthy and comfort. It's my most personal book yet, and also the most practical. It will be out on March 2nd, but it's available for pre-order now everywhere books are sold. If you'd like a signed copy, head to the link in the show notes or head to my website, juliatertian.com, for all of the information to order from my local bookstore, Oblong Books. If you enjoy the conversations I have on this podcast, I am sure you are going to love this book. It's got a similar intimacy, and I just can't wait for you to cook from it. Okay, on to today's episode. Christina Gill is a Nashville-born food and travel photographer and cookbook author who lives and works in Rome. She was the food and drinks editor at Design Sponge for over a decade, where she worked very closely with my wife, Grace. In addition to her award-winning creative work in food, Christina is also a humanitarian advisor, and she supports the United Nations World Food Program in her day job, which focuses on food assistance during times of humanitarian crisis. Christina is an alum of both Stanford and the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She is one of the most informed people I know when it comes to the complexities of our global food systems. I've always wanted to learn more about this side of Christina's work and her thinking, and I am so grateful she was game to talk to me about it. We started by me asking her to share a bit more about her day job.
The work that I do is with the UN World Food Program.
Okay.
And the majority of the donors to World Food Program are governments. So I work for a government, for a mid-sized donor. The United States is the largest single government donor to the World Food Program. And you may not know, but World Food Program won the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize this year.
Oh, yeah.
For its work.
Okay. So you are not the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
No, I am not. No.
But you know
the organization won. You know, when the UN won the Peace Prize once, and when the UN won the Peace Prize, it was the UN, and then the Secretary General of the UN also won the Peace Prize. In this case, it was just the organization that won, but what I like to think of as the organization winning is all of the people who make the sacrifices in these very difficult circumstances, in these very difficult locations, often sacrificing their families, their marriages, their life, you know, like regular, like we have, to go and assist people in need. Mm-hmm. And so those are the people who make up the organization, and those are the people who collectively won the Peace Prize.
Got it. And
I took no claim.
And how long have you been doing this work? It's been for like a pretty long time, right?
Sure. I've been doing it for, let me do the math, 16 years.
16, sweet 16. And how did you find yourself in this type of work?
So I started out my professional career at the State Department. And I had a portfolio that was a multilateral portfolio, which meant that my work wasn't just with a single government. So it wasn't bilateral work. It was multilateral work. And when I resigned from the State Department, I was looking for a job here. I saw an announcement for a job looking for someone with multilateral experience.
And
I had multilateral experience
here
in Rome,
Italy. Okay, yes, go on.
And I looked for, I applied for the job and I got it.
And that was that. And you've been in the same job for 16 years.
Oh my God, you make it sound so bad. Yes, I've been in a dead end. I've been in a dead-end job for 16 years. There is no upward mobility, but I like the job because it has all of the aspects of my job in the diplomatic corps. So it has intellectually challenging. It is plugged into current events. It's not political. It shouldn't be political, though. It obviously there are political currents that drive the events that create the crises.
That's interesting.
And you know, there's a lot of contacts between people, and at the same time, I do that part-time, actually. And that leaves me space to cultivate my other interests. The food, the luxurious side of food, as opposed to the lacking side of food.
And do you feel like I feel like you have a foot in both of these worlds. Like, and do you feel like having that kind of dual perspective? I mean, I guess you wouldn't know any other way, right? But like, how does your awareness of things like the lack of food and the understanding of everything that informs that, like, how does that affect your standing in the world of more luxurious food and vice versa? Like, what does that dual perspective offer you?
Oh, gosh. From the outside, I mean, from other people looking at me, I don't know what it offers. from looking to the outside, I kind of feel like there are a lot of things that I don't consider important. Like, I think a lot of people make mountains out of molehills, or they live in a sheltered area in which there's not perspective for the 99%. Which are people who don't choose, or I shouldn't say the 99%, but let's just say for the bottom 10% of the poorest of the poor, which is who WFP serves, 90 million, 100 million people. That number is going up because of COVID. But let's just say the beneficiaries that WFP helps, they don't get to choose whether they skip a meal. They don't get to choose what food they're going to eat. They don't wax poetic about different tomato types. They don't, you know, this is not something that food is a necessity for life, for survival. And I think when you get stuck into the luxurious side of food and revel in it, you can kind of lose that perspective.
Yeah.
Like, I am really, really, really remind myself every single day, like when I'm hungry or really hungry, I never, ever, ever say I'm starving because there are people who are starving. And like, realistically, I could live a long time without eating and probably fare pretty well living off the fat of the land, so to speak. The land being myself. but also, I mean, I just consider myself extremely lucky to be able to have the disposable income to make nutritious choices.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I don't have a lot of tolerance for foolishness, but I don't express that externally. You know, it's just me. I just have to remind myself to keep a level head and not lose perspective of things.
Yeah. I think that the space between these two things, like the understanding that, you know, hunger remains huge in this world, and there's also a world in which food is such a luxury and we can wax poetic about all the different types of tomatoes. Like, there is such a distance between these two worlds, and holding on to that perspective just feels not just like valuable to me, but vital. And what do you think are some ways for people who are unaware of this to be more aware?
You don't have to go very far. You don't have to leave the United States. You don't have to leave your state. You don't have to leave your city, even. I mean, even in the United States, we have food banks. And you've been seeing this on the news about how many families are having to go to food banks to get to the end of the month. And I think on the one hand, luckily, you have Albertsons and supermarket chains that are partners of these food banks that provide food to families in need. At the same time, I think that highlights the imperfections in the market, in the sense that there's enough food to feed everyone in the world, but, you know, there's enough money to solve these problems, mm-hmm. but people have to give it, the food has to be made available. So mm-hmm. you have things like you go to the supermarket to buy your food and you see all this beautiful, perfect produce. Well, for every perfect zucchini that you see there, maybe there was one that was ugly that just got tossed out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why can't we eat ugly zucchini? It's the same. Why do we have to have a refrigerator full of perfect zucchini? Is it mm-hmm. because we want them to fit perfectly in the refrigerator? Like, it tastes the same. Everything's the same. But if it's ugly, we won't eat it. And that food gets thrown away. That type of thing, honestly, my opinion, should be illegal. Like, there, you shouldn't mm-hmm. be able to grade produce that way and throw it out. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's just really, I think it's kind of mind over matter. First of all, it's helping people if you can. And the second thing is just being mindful of the fact that you're fortunate, because the fact of the matter is, in the United States, these people are going to a food bank and they're waiting in line for food at a food bank, but they're driving there, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. They have the clothes that they need. They have the house and they would be struggling for it. Outside of the United States, it's even worse. So, I mean, we really don't have it as bad as other people do. And there are people in the United States who do have it bad. But probably people who are listening to this podcast are not part of that demographic. And I just really think it's just being mindful of how you consume and what you consume. And, you know, just asking yourself, is there anything I can do that could make a difference, even in a tiny way? It doesn't have to be drastic or dramatic, but just to be a mindful consumer.
Do you think, because, you know, I think about these sort of individual kind of acts a lot. You know, I think about what's happening in my zip code and what can I do to be involved. And, you know, Grace and I do a lot of, you know, work in our community. And I'm always thinking on this sort of small scale, this like considering each other neighbors, like that kind of feeling. And I feel like you have the understanding and perspective of a much more global, like macro scale. And I'm heartened to hear what you're saying about, you know, people just kind of thinking about what kind of small difference can they make. And I guess I'm just wondering, do you feel like those small, like individual acts, I guess, do you feel like they matter? Like, if things are these huge logistical, like policy issues, is me helping out at my local food pantry, in your opinion, does that matter?
I think it matters. Yeah. I think it matters because it's because you're aware that many people of the meals that you're fixing, that you're preparing, are in need. Mm-hmm. And if you don't take the time to get involved, you don't even know. Mm-hmm. You know, my husband, he's Italian and very affected by the previous generation, which in Italy, there was hunger in Italy. There was hunger in Europe. There was rationing. So his parents were little during the Second World War. He knew his grandparents who were older during the Second World War, and he won't throw anything away. Yesterday, he asked me what I went to go get a cookie, and he, you know, had some cookies fell on the floor, and he was like, I cooked. He toasted the cookies because they fell on the floor. And I was like, look, throw them away. It's like all you did was like toast dirt on the outside of cookies. I was like, we don't have to eat cookies. So I have this, you know, like, I don't feel bad about throwing cookies away.
If they've been crushed on the floor.
Like, well, no, I mean, that's also a question I have in my head too. Like, is it a sin to waste junk food? For him, it is awful to waste food. Now, but he's even more just strict about wasting food to the point of, you know, sometimes he'll eat, I don't know, vegetables that have gone off a little bit, and he knows not to serve those to me. But if there's a way to figure out how to make vegetables that have gone off a little bit that you can't taste them, he would do it. And so I just think having that kind of awareness of what I think I would also say that changes happen because people ask for changes. And going to your supermarket chain and talking to the customer service desk to say, you know, look, why don't you have imperfect vegetables here? If enough people do it, maybe they try it out, and maybe that decreases the amount of prepared foods where you don't have to see a perfect zucchini, and they're actually not throwing away the imperfect zucchini, and they're putting it into something. So, you know, little things help. I can honestly say that doing this, I look at the scale of the need and the numbers of people who need assistance. When you look at Yemen, you've got almost the entire country that needs assistance, and you're talking tens of millions of people, almost an entire country. And really, one single person cannot do it. Well, maybe Jeff Bezos could just like give all of his money. And I mean that seriously.
Yeah. I think that the global humanitarian outlook for the next year was a number like $35 billion.
That's ideal, right? Like, even if he gave, I don't know, $1 billion, that still would help just a little bit for 1 year. But my point is, a single person can't do it, but little gestures, little acts can help in the small area. And that's as much as you can expect, right? Just take care of your own area. If everybody's taking care of their own area, that every area is taken care of. And another thing I would say that is kind of annoying is that there are a lot of people who would like to help, and it's just so hard to get the opportunity to help, to be able to volunteer. And I don't know, I'm not someone from the other side who is vetting volunteers and taking people on. And maybe you know more about that, because you've been successful at being, I'm going to use the word employed, even though I know it's not employment, but, you know, at getting a role as a volunteer. There are a lot of people who would like to help and who are turned away. So maybe making those types of things easier also can help.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I think about a lot, because I think about what are the circumstances in my life that allow me to be a consistent volunteer. And those circumstances are so incredibly privileged, right? Like, I have freedom of time and financial freedom. You know, I'm able to devote a regular amount of time during the weekday every week to doing this kind of work. And, you know, that's because I'm self-employed, you know, I don't have to be somewhere else. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into making that possible. And I think so much about the fact that the volunteer work Grace and I do together, we've been able to get to know much older people in our community. And often they have similar circumstances. They, you know, are retired or whatever it might be. They have the ability to be there during the day, you know, on like a weekday morning. And I wonder so often about how to sort of bridge that gap between the need for volunteers and making things accessible for volunteers. And again, it's a scale thing and it's, you know, reframing things. And I think any organization that runs on volunteers is really, really difficult to run. And there's just a lot of things that get in the way of making it possible. And I'm always wondering about, yeah, how things are organized and run and what the operations side of things looks like. And that's a place where my mind kind of just goes like at short circuits. Like I start thinking about it and then I'm like, oh God, this is too much. Like I just want to show up and do my thing. But I feel like the people who do have the ability to think in those terms, you know, they are needed and they need people like me who just want to show up and, you know, cook for a few hours every week and who will be reliable and consistent. Like we need all the parts, right? Like I don't have to figure out how to run the place I volunteer. I just need to keep showing up. And, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about a lot. I don't know the answers. I just appreciate getting to kind of talk about it and think about it. And I really appreciate the, you know, big, large scale perspective you have. And when you talk about it, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't sound overwhelmed to me. Like you sound informed and like aware, and like you seem to have really like clear expectations based on what is happening. Like I hear about these things and I feel overwhelmed. Is that accurate? Do you feel overwhelmed when you talk about it? Or
no, when I talk about it, no. I mean, there are times when I have lots of meetings to go to where we're getting briefings on the situation, you know, the worst 30 situations, crises in the world, where it is depressing and where you do realize that you're one person and the needs are ginormous. And when the COVID crisis hit and the lockdown happened and it became very clear almost immediately the impact that it would have on livelihoods, on, you know, people, on everything, businesses, small businesses, people who, you know, got their dream together and had just opened in January or February. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the backbone of our communities. And then you realize that just like the global financial crisis in 2008, that there's going to be a rung of the ladder that is going to disappear. Mm. And what are we going to do for those people? And how are we going to help those people to find vocations? Because I don't think that there are that many people out there who want a handout. They want to be able to work. They want to be able to do what they were trained to do. They want to be useful members of society. And if there is no longer retail, then what happens for those people? If, you know, your restaurants close, then what happens for those people? If there are no longer taxi drivers, for example, because of self-driving cars, what do you do for these people? And for me, that causes a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. When, you know, above and beyond the families who don't have enough money to make it to the end of the month, what's tomorrow going to look like for these people? And so that for me is overwhelming when I think about, you know, I consider, yeah, I have a job that's kind of a white collar, use my brain kind of job. But I think that after the global financial crisis, after coronavirus, I would say people like me with an undergraduate degree and a master's doing what I'm doing, I'm pretty much the bottom of the rung now. And the next crisis, then, you know, where my rung is going to drop off. And up until, you know, recently, someone with my level of education was considered pretty much out of danger. And, you know, those are the things you kind of have to, well, you don't have to, but those are the things that I think about, not about myself. I don't really care that in that regard, but, you know, people who really are hurting. And that's what overwhelms me. And that is literally sometimes what keeps me up at night. Mm-hmm. And that was very depressing for me at the beginning of the crisis, and still is kind of a damper. It's just, you know, seeing your community disappear, seeing people lose what they worked their lives for, seeing a generational business disappear. It hurts you, or I feel bad for them. And, you know, I spent way more money than I should have trying to help businesses, you know, buying here and there and everything else, just, you know, going to my friends who had businesses saying, will it help you if I buy this? And they say, mm-hmm. yes. So, okay. Going and spending, you know, $100, $200 to buy something, hoping that they stay afloat. Yeah. I don't know. That's what's depressing for me, is people just losing everything.
It is. I mean, it is depressing. And I think it's important to name it as such. And, you know, there's collective grief around that, as there should be, you know, like it's incredibly upsetting. And I'm wondering, you know, you've been in your job for 16 years. You've seen many, you know, different types of crisis. What's the plural of crisis? Crises? Why am I like blanking on that? You've seen many difficult situations.
I think it's crises.
Crises.
I knew someone who would say crises.
Just like I had, like my mind just went blank. How do you, you know, you do have sleepless nights. You are thinking about these huge issues all the time. Like, how do you maintain your drive, and how do you not get burnt out, or do you? And how do you manage that?
Thursday, I had seven and a half hours of Zoom meetings. And by the end of the day, I was just, you know, ready to scream and run away and never come back. So it can get intense activity-wise, being in meetings all day where your brain has to be on all day, taking mm-hmm. notes all day, and then writing summaries of these notes. So burnout in that sense. I wouldn't necessarily say burnout from the substance of the work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then staying motivated. I don't know. I haven't, that's a good question. I've asked myself the exact same thing, because I think sometimes it's good to take a break, but I just think sometimes you take a break, you know, it's like when your feet are swollen and your shoes, and you're like, I just got to take my shoes off. Mm-hmm. And then you take your shoes off and you can't get them back on. And so maybe you never should have taken your shoes off to begin with. Sometimes I think vacations, like taking a break from work, are kind of like that. Like you take a break and you realize, like, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't go back. Like maybe this is the time to change.
Yeah.
And maybe it is time for me to change, but I haven't quite figured out what I want to change to. So, yeah.
So your shoes are still on. Maybe you're just like loosening the laces a little.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I'm trying to evaluate mm-hmm. that. Maybe if I take these shoes off. Yeah. Is there a store nearby where I can buy some flip-flops?
When I'm working on recipes for my books, like each one in Simply Julia, I am thinking not just about how the recipes will work right now, but if they'll still feel like something you'll want to make years from now. I aim to make work that lasts. And this is something I have in common with my friends at OXO. Their products are engineered for functionality and durability. They guarantee them for life. For more about OXO's guarantee and everything they make, head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com.
I'm curious about what you feel about the term food justice and like how you define it. Yeah, I'm curious about that.
That's a good question, because I guess it's a good question because I think that food justice is, why don't you tell me what you think of food justice, and I'll give you my reaction.
I mean, I'm asking because it's a term that I hear more frequently, you know, than ever. And a term I've used before, but I feel like I pause often because I don't know the exact definition. And I think maybe that's the point. I think there's like many definitions, but now I'm just talking around the thing, right? Like, I mean, to me, food justice is understanding that food is like a human right and doing whatever you can to ensure access for everyone to have, you know, healthy, nourishing food that's culturally appropriate and just food they enjoy and makes them feel good and sustains their life. Yeah, I guess that's what I think about it. How does that land?
I don't know. I guess, you know, that is, what do I think about it? I guess my mindset is always on much larger scale, much more dire situations. I don't even know how to answer this, because if I look at food justice and I look at food justice in the United States and access to food and food deserts and access to culturally appropriate food on the one hand, and then I look at, you know, there are 30 million people in the world who, if they don't get assistance from WFP on a daily basis, they will die. Mm-hmm. I kind of look at food justice and I think, okay, that's tomorrow's problem, because I have someone over here who's going to starve. Now I should be able to walk and chew gum and also look at food justice and say, okay, this is a different setting. This is not somewhere in Yemen. This is the United States. And how do we deal with this? And I think I might be a little bit out of touch.
We all, I think, hold many things at the same time in life in general. And I think when it comes to the two sides of the food coin, like hunger and then abundance on the other side, I feel like you hold those things at the same time. And there's a dissonance between those and there's like tension, and I don't always know how to hold both those things. So
in non-crisis times, many of the issues are the exact same. These are land rights, people being able to have the right to their land, to be able to farm their land, to be able to use the food that comes from their land, or to have the livestock to keep them on the land. These issues are quite similar. Food systems, nutritious food systems, access to healthy food, sustainable food systems, non-damaging supply chains. These issues are the same in non-crisis times. I mean, I guess they're the same in crisis times, but crisis times are, you know, they're time specific. These issues exist all over the world. So I look at them, I recognize them, and I do think about them, but I haven't dug into the food systems issues or the food justice issues yet. Although I can tell you there is a food systems summit that is coming up.
Okay.
And someone has asked me, hey, Christina, why don't you use your platform to make people more aware of the sustainable development goals with relationship to food and of the food system summit that is coming up. And so I'm trying to think about how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not an answer to any of the questions you're asking.
That's okay.
It's a roundabout way of saying that I'm getting there.
Yeah.
To thinking about food justice and what does food justice mean? And what role does food justice have in my set of issues? Because realistically speaking, I think that people have their own set of issues that are important to them at, you know, a very personal level. Doesn't mean that they don't care about other important issues. It just means that certain things have touched them in one way or another, and they're really active on that level. And for example, I'm really interested in diversity in food full stop, whether it is journalism, whether it is, you know, access to credit, whether it is in publishing, whether it is in film, whether it is, you know, across the board, diversity and equal access and equal exposure and equal opportunity. That is something that's interesting to me. And thinking about food justice, I have to see how I can work that in.
If you're enjoying this conversation, come join me on my virtual book tour for Simply Julia. I'm so excited to join friends and colleagues like Dory Greenspan, Ashley C. Ford, Nick Sharma, and Deb Perlman from Smitten Kitchen, along with people you might remember from episodes of Keep Calm and Cook On, like Patty Heenich, Gia Tolentino, and Anthony from Netflix's Queer Eye. These conversations will be happening live on platforms like Zoom with the support of independent bookstores across the country. Any and all are welcome, and all of the information is available at juliatertian.com/events. That's juliatertian.com/events. The link is also in the show notes. Okay, back to today's conversation.
I want to move back to the United States, and a lot of people talk about ditching the United States and leaving, you know, let's just ball it up, throw it away and leave. Mm-hmm. And I'm the exact opposite. I kind of feel like, you know, now or always is the time to fight for the country, but everything is so important across the board. Where do I start? Where do I go? Is it, you know, what is the best bang for the effort? And, you know, like, I care a lot about elections. Is it gerrymandering? No. Is it, you know, fair fight, what Stacey Abrams did? You know, is it the turning out to vote? Is it education, as you mentioned? You know, if we arm people with an education, then is that the best foundation that we can give people to go and confront social inequality, food inequality, all of the inequalities? Or is it, you know, early childhood development? Does it have to do more with maternal health issues and family issues? So I get it. I just have to decide.
Yeah, because it's D, all of the above, right? It's just figuring out which one are you going to devote your time and attention and your incredibly smart brain to, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I think a lot, I'm from Nashville, and I think a lot about Nashville and the breakneck pace of gentrification in Nashville. And, you know, I wanted to be on the Nashville Farmers Market board. And I looked at the, you know, look at the minutes of the meeting and everything. And at the time, the mayor at the time wanted more farmers or more people who had connections with farmers on the board. And that meant that she wanted more chefs on the board. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the chefs that she wanted on the board, there really was no diversity in that. And I realized pretty quickly that, okay, then that's not the place for me, because I have like zero chance of getting on that. How can I deal with food issues and access to food and nutritious food in Nashville? And that is something that I've thought a lot about, because, you know, entire demographics are being shoved out of their neighborhoods, and then food will be brought in. But there's no effort to bring in the food now to make these neighborhoods nice neighborhoods, to give, you know, a little park or, you know, the things that are in other neighborhoods. But once you push people out, then the city starts to take an interest. Mm-hmm. I just kind of don't like that.
Yeah.
So I've thought about food justice in that sense, more access to food and food deserts, but quite specifically in my hometown, happening across the street from where my father lives.
Yeah. I often think about that, like, if we can think about it in terms of where our family members live, quite literally, like, whether that's, you know, your father for you, or, you know, chosen family in any way. I think when we make it personal, it becomes undeniable.
I kind of feel like I haven't answered any of your questions. Like, I'm gonna be like a really good politician, because they say, like, if you're a politician. So I did this training once, like, well, it wasn't really training, but it's like exercises for public diplomacy if you had to like be a spokesperson. And so all of us that were in the group had to answer questions. And so everybody got their critique afterwards. And the critique of me was that I was the only person who actually answered the questions that I was asked. And normally you would say, hey, that's great. But they were like, you don't want to do that. The rule is you answer the question you wanted to be asked. Mm. So sorry, I didn't actually answer your questions. I answered the questions that I wanted to be asked because your questions are too hard.
Well, I'm just going to, I think there might be a compliment in there. So I'll just say thanks. And I think also, I just appreciate, this is why I enjoy talking to you and always wish I got to talk to you more, because I think you have a way of, I think in not answering a direct question, you have a way of, No, but you're like unfolding it. It's like, I feel like the paper is really small and then you're like, wait, no, look at all these different sides of it. And that's just something I really value. So thank you for not answering my questions.
Now I feel bad. I wish I were smarter so that I could answer them.
Please. Oh my gosh. No.
I were more prepared.
No. All good. If anyone listening to this feels moved to open their wallet, you know, if Jeff Bezos is listening to this podcast or anyone else, like, where would you suggest people give money to right now? Like, while they're listening, like, what website should they go to? What do you suggest in that area?
Well, obviously, I would say World Food Program. World Food Program. They have Share the Meal app where whenever you eat out, which most people in the major donor markets are not doing right now, give a percentage of their food, a percentage of the money they can give to contributions, or they can contribute directly to World Food Program. They can look and see if there are national committees, like the United States has World Food Program USA. But there are also other organizations. There's UNHCR, which helps refugees and internally displaced people. There is UNICEF, which helps children. There's WHO, which is on the health front. There are large international non-governmental organizations like CARE, and gosh, there are so many of them that can help, that have the reach and the scale to get to these people. But then there are also local NGOs. What I would say is, unless you are pretty crafty about researching the management of the smaller NGOs, it might be better to, you know, stick to the bigger ones or give it home, because the reason that governments are having a hard time giving money to these other crises abroad is because COVID has had such a devastating effect on economies at home. So governments are taking care of their domestic citizens, and that's kind of taxing out their dollars. Although, you know, the United States is stepping up to the plate. I can say that a lot of governments are finding money, but it's not enough.
Yeah. I will just add that, you know, I just jotted down each of the places you did mention, and I'll put them in, or they are currently in the show notes. So that's all there. You know, you don't have to scramble to remember all those things. They're all there. And just, yeah, feel free to share that list. And I appreciate all those really important places you brought up and mentioned.
It's going to be your most depressing podcast.
You know what I think? I think that if you are choosing to listen to a podcast that's like conversations around food, and I feel like every episode of this podcast has been not so much about food, it's like about like all these things around food and how it makes you feel and what it brings up. And I just think everything we're talking about is super important, and it's part of that conversation. So I don't know. I didn't find this depressing. I found it sobering. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate your insight. And I've just always admired your ability to think on these big scales and not be scared of that. And that's something I really value. So I'm grateful to be able to share that. So that's how I feel this moment.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. I mean, look, it is depressing, but you are helping, and everybody, we can always do more. And if we've ever chosen to not eat because we weren't feeling too well or to skip a meal, then we are wealthy enough to make a difference in our community.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's a really good way to think about it. I have one last question that I promised was...
Is this the fun one?
This is a fun one. And it's the question I ask everyone at the end. And I cannot wait to hear your answer. Okay. So much build up to this question. Oh my goodness. Okay. Christina Gill, when you were a little kid, little Christina in Nashville, what was your favorite thing to eat?
Oh my God. People always ask me this. And I totally did not have a favorite thing to eat. I didn't have favorite things to eat until I got older, and I can't even remember. As a matter of fact, I will tell you, that is a security question for some like website, and I always have to have my password reset because I cannot remember the answer. So I'm going to say chocolate cake. I changed the security question, by the way, guys, because it just wasn't working for me.
We won't be logging into your email. Don't worry.
Well, who knows what it is? It may or may not be chocolate cake. It apparently isn't because that wasn't right. But let's just say chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Cake.
What kind? Are we talking like a dense fudgy cake, a really cakey cake, frosting, sprinkles, nuts?
So probably as a child, I liked a little bit of frosting. However, I do not like frosting.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Christina.
I always rake it off.
Yep, me too.
I figure I get more bang for the buck because all the calories that I scrape off means I can eat more cake. And I like cake. Like if you say, oh, do you like brownies? I'm like, yeah, I don't like fudgy brownies. I like cakey brownies. And people say, okay, then why don't you just eat cake? And I was like, well, thank you. I will. And so I like cake, you know, just good chocolate, moist chocolate cake.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you.
Duncan Hines, chocolate cake from a mix.
Totally.
Betty Crocker, chocolate cake. Just chocolate cake.
Yeah. It's so, I feel like everyone loves frosting and I always feel like the odd one who's, I mean, I like a little bit, like I like a smear of frosting.
Yeah.
That's and I'm it, always scraping it off. Grace wants the frosting and I want the cake. And that's why things have worked out so well, I think.
Yeah. I always am more than happy to give you all of my frosting. I just need just a little bit.
Yeah. Just a little bit. Well, I'm glad we have that in common amongst so many.
Well,
other
we
things.
Couldn't be married then.
Christina, thank you for your time, for your intellect, and all the information. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah.
And for challenging me.
I mean, anytime. And next time we'll do it over cake. So.
Oh, great.
I promise
okay.
that.
Perfect.
Thanks again to OXO for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com for more. Thanks for listening to this episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. Head to juliatertian.com for more about the show and for all of the information about my new cookbook, Simply Julia. A pre-ordered copy is a gift to your future self. Please consider ordering one today from your favorite bookseller. If you'd like a signed copy, head to juliatertian.com/simplyjulia and check out the information about personalized copies from Oblong Books, one of my favorite booksellers. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, take care.